You're listening to Asia First Weekend Edition. Me, Justine Moss. A very good Saturday morning to you, as always. Crossing now to our US Bureau Chief, Simon Marks, in Washington, D.C. Hi, Simon.
Hello, Justine.
Thanks once again for joining us here in Singapore. Let's start off with the G7 summit. Lots being discussed in that beautiful county of Cornwall, one of my favourite places in England. Things like cybersecurity, there's the global tax rate, of course, aid for countries and climate change. The Queen also held a dinner for world leaders.
Yes, and like you, every time I see pictures of this extraordinary area in the west of the UK where this is being held, I just sit there salivating, wondering when I'm ever going to see Britain again. But that's a whole other story. The Queen did indeed, at the end of day one of the G7 summit, host a dinner for everyone at a botanical garden that is basically a bit of a biosphere. It's called the Eden Project, and various members of the royal family have been very involved in backing it over the years, not far from the site where world leaders, hosted by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, held their first full day of talks. We know that the talks are going to focus very, very heavily on how their respective economies can recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, and also reflective of the fact that the economies are recovering at different rates. So, you know, the US President Joe Biden making his first official overseas visit as president can bask in the relative glory of the fact that the American economy appears to be bouncing back in a relatively steady fashion. Certainly, the US economy much further down that road than any of the other economies represented around that table. And Boris Johnson, in convening this first day of talks today, said that it's very important for the leaders to be frank and open with one another, not just about the directions in which they want to take their countries going forward, but frank about mistakes that they may have made on the path to battling the pandemic thus far. And, you know, one got the sense that Boris Johnson is keenly aware of all of that, because he finds himself in a difficult position right now in Britain with the Delta variant that was first identified in India, now causing a pretty dramatic increase in new cases in the UK, surge testing underway in various parts of the country. Even earlier in the week, President Biden on Twitter citing the spread of the Delta variant in the UK as a reason for Americans to get vaccinated against COVID-19, because we know that variant is now present here in the United States as well. And Boris Johnson's got this difficult decision to make about whether he's going to lift the remaining COVID-19 restrictions in place on schedule on the 21st of June, or whether he's going to accede to the desire of some public health officials for some of those measures to remain in place while the country sees where the Delta variant is going. So you could kind of see Boris Johnson grappling with all of that, even as he began what certainly was a session that had lots on its agenda, and much of it areas where President Biden was going to find himself under pressure from other members of the G7, who want to know why, for example, steel and aluminium tariffs that were imposed by Donald Trump are still in place. The French want to know why America is closed still to fully vaccinated tourists from France, but fully vaccinated Americans can spend the summer on the beaches of the south of France if they choose. So lots to talk about, but obviously it's COVID-19 that's hanging over this whole thing.
Yeah, and they're pledging, I think, 1 billion vaccines to poorer countries. President Biden promising 500 million of those, and Boris Johnson promising around 100 million.
Yeah, and taken together, the G7 leaders will reach that 1 billion figure in pledges, but the lion's share of it, 50% of it, will be coming from one country alone, and that's the United States. And I think it became very evident over the last few days that President Biden and Boris Johnson, and presumably some of the other leaders sitting around the table as well, view vaccine diplomacy as a primary tool for trying to persuade the rest of the world that liberal democracies are uniquely placed not just to engage in acts of charitable largesse and, you know, the 500, half a billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine that the United States is pledging to buy and distribute over the course of the next 12 months, completely outpaces the vaccine diplomacy that has already been set in train by the Russians and the Chinese. But President Biden has been at pains throughout to underscore that when G7 member states give vaccines away, they're not expecting anything in return. There's no quid pro quo. And the inference that he's drawing is that the Russians and the Chinese are looking for some kind of leverage over the countries that they bestow their vaccines upon. But that's not the way, the president says, liberal democracies do it. So this is all part and parcel of his building a coalition of democracies, demonstrating through the talks that he's having at the G7 and then the subsequent meetings that he's got with EU leaders and at NATO headquarters ahead of his big summit meeting next Wednesday with Vladimir Putin in Geneva. By the time he walks into that room in Geneva, he is hoping that he will have demonstrated in a muscular fashion that the United States and other liberal democracies are selflessly doing things for the rest of the world, and that there's a contrast between them and the autocracies of Russia and China, with which the president says the US is engaged in a battle for the 21st century.
Simon, before we just move to domestic news, let's just talk about the spouses as well. I mean, they've been having a very busy time down there in Cornwall. Jill Biden touring a school in Cornwall with the Duchess of Cambridge.
Yes, and Jill Biden arriving for the first day of the G7 meeting, flanked, of course, by her husband, President Biden, met by Boris Johnson and his now wife, Carrie Johnson. And she said, you could hear her saying as she started walking up these wooden boards that had been placed on a beautiful sandy beach in Cornwall, terribly picturesque for all the world leaders to walk down as they headed into the meeting. You could hear Jill Biden saying, I feel like I'm at a wedding. Well, certainly she and some of the other spouses are being treated as honored guests by Carrie Johnson and the Duchess of Cambridge and others. Jill Biden was taken to a school that specializes in educating children who have been through infant and childhood traumas. She took a tray of carrots with her because they have rabbits at the school, and she was encouraging the children to feed the bunnies with the carrots. And she and the Duchess of Cambridge had quite an extensive conversation about the school and the way in which it goes about its academic work. Remember that Jill Biden herself is a teacher and a very committed educator. A bit of news was made by the Duchess of Cambridge when she was asked whether she was asked, first of all, about the birth of Meghan and Harry's daughter, Lilibet, out in California, named, of course, after the Queen. And she said she was very excited and delighted for them. She was asked if she had seen the baby yet on FaceTime and said, no, she hadn't, which raised some questions among the British press corps. Not sure whether Jill Biden was particularly concerned about that, though.
You're listening to Asia First Weekend Edition. Me, Justine Moss, this Saturday morning, speaking with Simon Marks, our US Bureau Chief in Washington, D.C. Simon, let's go to this story now out of Baltimore. The US FDA says that Johnson & Johnson must throw away millions of doses of its COVID-19 vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, this is just astonishing. And we've been waiting for this FDA decision for weeks. You will remember that there's a factory up in Baltimore that was paid hundreds of millions of dollars by the U.S. government to be the standby manufacturing facility to crank out vaccines in the case of any kind of major public health surprise for the United States. Lo and behold, along came COVID-19. So the U.S. government said, right, you better start cranking out these vaccines. And then, of course, there were reports that the factory had mixed up the ingredients for the Pfizer vaccine for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine with the AstraZeneca ingredients. Those are the two jabs they've been making at this factory. Then a subsequent investigation revealed that there were sanitary difficulties at the factory, and that it wasn't following industry standard health and hygiene regulations. So the FDA has been looking at about 170 million doses of Johnson and Johnson vaccine that were produced at this plant. They've now deemed that 60 million of them need simply to be thrown away and discarded. There's about 20 million of them that they say they're going to ship out on the understanding that the receiving states and countries to which they're shipped will have to make their own decision about whether to use them, because the FDA cannot guarantee that they have been produced in industry standard conditions. And there's still, you know, about another, well, substantial amount of vaccine, about another 100 million doses of vaccine that they have to look at to determine whether they are viable for use or not. The only bit of good news that came out of the FDA today was the fact that they do now believe that unused Johnson & Johnson vaccine, surplus vaccine that hasn't been used by its expiration date, can be refrigerated for at least another month and a half beyond the expiration date. So there's a bit of time left for everyone to determine what to do with all of these doses of vaccine. But the real problem is this. You know, President Biden says he's going to give away 500 million doses of vaccine, but only 200 million doses of that 500 million will go out of the door before the end of this year. The rest of it's all happening in the first 6 months of next year, because these vaccines take a while to produce. If you now remove 60 million, maybe more, doses of vaccine from the available global supply, that is going to have a chilling effect on some of the low and middle income countries that are desperate to get their hands on vaccines as soon as possible. So certainly in various parts of Africa, there has been really grave anxiety over these developments by the Food and Drug Administration, an enormous black eye for that plant in Baltimore and for American infrastructure's reputation generally. And also, once again, and we spoke about this last weekend, you know, this extraordinary contrast between countries all over the world absolutely clamoring for vaccine and a United States that now seems not to be on track to meet President Biden's goal of getting 70% of adult Americans at least one jab by July the 4th, because the numbers of people seeking vaccines in the United States continues to ebb. So this raises just a whole raft of questions, and there are very few good answers right now about those J&J jabs from for the countries that are so eager to get their hands on them and start pumping them into the arms of their citizens.
Simon, let's now go to this story about, you know, the Department of Justice and in the Trump administration, Democrats demanding a probe into reports that they subpoenaed Apple for data from the accounts of House Intelligence Committee Democrats, including Chairman Adam Schiff.
Well, this is utterly extraordinary, and the Justice Department's Inspector General has now opened an inquiry into what appears to have been a sweeping attempt during the Trump administration by the Department of Justice to get their hands on the metadata pertaining to the email accounts and the computer systems of Democrats in the House of Representatives. As Donald Trump, former president, insisted on major action to find out who was leaking classified information to the media. There are elements of this that are very reminiscent of Richard Nixon's presidency, the kind of the enemies list that he used to keep, because this is all coming in the week when we've also learnt that there was a substantial effort by the Department of Justice to acquire and ultimately to obtain phone records for journalists at the Washington Post, at CNN, at the New York Times, and possibly at other media houses. Now, you know, all of this is no go in the United States. Democrats in the House of Representatives have a right, especially on the Intelligence Committee of all committees, to have their communications, assume that those communications are private and secure. And similarly, the First Amendment conveys really no power on the U.S. government to be snooping on the phone records of American journalists unless there was a real case to be made that possible crimes were being committed. So this, I think, is going to raise absolutely enormous questions for Trump-era officials. The former Attorney General, William Barr, has been insisting that he knew nothing about this request for metadata to be gathered from members of the House of Representatives. But that is not going to, I think, avoid him from being a key focus for this investigation. And, you know, it does indeed raise enormous questions about whether there were things going on in the Trump administration that were unconstitutional. And, I think that's going to lead to a raft of fresh questions being asked.
Going to be interesting. Simon, let's finish off with the markets now. Interesting, choppy week, but the S&P did eke out record closing highs. Traders are shaking off those inflation concerns.
Yeah, I was just going to say, not bad, given that there were inflation concerns this week when the numbers came out and we saw the largest rise in inflation year on year since 2008. With the year-on-year inflation number hitting 5%, worse than the market had expected. On the markets today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed just less than 1%, a tenth of a percentage point higher. The S&P 500 up 0.19 percentage point in value, and the Nasdaq up about a third of a percentage point in value. All eyes are going to be on the Federal Reserve, though, over the next few days. They've got meetings next week at which we are waiting to see how they react to what are clearly inflationary fears now in the United States. The Fed's got to decide to what extent it's going to taper off asset purchases in a bid to provide fresh stimulus to the economy. They're worried about how exactly they communicate all of that, because, of course, it led to substantial capital flight in emerging markets back in 2008 when the Fed didn't engage in the kind of very careful messaging that I think members of the Federal Reserve Board now believe will be necessary as they move away from stimulus. But they're not quite ready to move away from stimulus yet, because they've said there would have to be a substantial decrease in the number of unemployed in the United States. And we don't think we've yet reached the point where the numbers are what the Fed would describe as substantial enough. It was the markets ended the day in positive territory, but there's definite nervousness out there as a result of those inflationary numbers that we saw. And I think we're going to have to wait and see what comes next week after that Fed meeting and see how the markets respond to that to get a sense of precisely where everyone's head is on it.
Simon, as always, thank you so much for joining us here in Singapore and keeping us updated what's happening over there.
Thanks a lot, Justine. Talk tomorrow.
Simon Marks there, our US Bureau Chief, speaking to me from Washington, D.C.